Welcome to another episode of the Gay Bar Archive Show, where we explore gay history, one bar at a time. I'm your host, Art Smith, and today we'll be joined by prolific author and gay historian, Saint Suki Delacroix. Welcome to the show, Suki.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Oh, you're quite welcome. How could I not? I mean, your name is all over the place. When I look up gay literature and gay history and gay Chicago, it pops up everywhere. How could I leave you out of this?
Well, I'm extremely popular, but not many people know me. My real friends hate the sight of me, you know, but everybody else loves me, you know.
Well loved by the people who don't know you.
That's right.
So let's put this into perspective a little bit because, you know, I know you have written gay novels and you've also written gay history books. And you certainly do not sound like a Midwesterner. So
No. You obviously
came across the pond at some point. Where did your gay writing career start?
Well, it started in England about 1980. If you mean gay writing career, that's when I started writing for gay papers. I mean, I was always gay or bisexual or whatever. But the first time I started writing gay was for gay newspapers. It was about 80, 81, maybe 82. I'm not sure. And it was a paper in London called Capital Gay. And then I branched out and did other things with Gay Times. And I'm a bit of a whore. I'll write for anybody, really, as long as I can write what I want.
So at some point, I guess you decided you were going to come across the pond and you landed in Chicago?
Yeah, well, my mission in England was complete as far as I was concerned. I was, they couldn't wait to see the back of me. So I met my husband. He was working in England and he was American. And I suppose we had a choice of staying there or coming to the States. And I felt it was time to throw everything away and start all over again. So that's what happened.
So how Chicago? How did Chicago come into the picture?
He just happened to own an apartment there. And that's why I went over there. And then I went to, once I got to Chicago, I went to Tracy Baim from Windy City Times and Outlines newspaper. And I started working for her in about 1995. Just doing news stories and feature articles. And she was great because she always let me do what I want.
And obviously you spent quite a bit of time working in the gay press and chronicling the stories of the gay bars in Chicago, of which there were many.
Right. That really started about 1999. I was in a bar. I wasn't really a bar person, but I was in a bar. I was in a leather bar in Chicago, and there was two. Oh, of course, I was younger then. Now I'm old. There were two old leather queens, and they were arguing, drunk off their ass. I noticed them because they were wearing sort of village people leather, so it was like antique leather, and they were arguing about the exact address of some old leather bar, Touches. And they were pushing each other. I thought, what an odd thing to argue about. So I started listening to people in bars. And I heard them talking about drag queens and the mafia owned the bars. And, you know, I come from Bath in England. We don't have the mafia there. We have, and this is the truth, we have the Fuchsia Society and the Chrysanthemum Society, and they hate each other. That's about as near as we get to the mafia. It's different groups fighting with each other. So I was quite excited by all this, and I went to Tracy Baim. Well, first I went to a bookstore and said, do you have a book on the history of lesbian and gay Chicago? And they said, no. So I went to Tracy Baim. I said, I'm going to start interviewing these people, just memories of the old bars, anything they want to talk about the old days. And I started writing a column called Chicago Whispers, and I went out to the bars with a little micro cassette recorder, and I'd drag people out the bars into the back alley away from the music, and I'd interview them. And it went on for 6 years. 1,000 words a week. And mostly talked about the first time they went to a bar. I always ask, start with the same question. When was the first time you went to a gay bar? And they light up, because that is a defining moment in nearly all gay people's lives, in the Western world anyway, is when they first walk into a gay bar. They see other people that are like them. So I always ask that question first. I have people talking about the bars in the 50s and the 60s and right back to the 30s with some of the old guys, you know. So that's when I started doing that. And after 6 years, I waited for some. I thought all this information could be used for a book and someone should write the book. And then I realized that nobody was going to write the book, so except me. So I. And that's what I usually do. I always write books that nobody else has written that I want to read. So I have to write them myself to read them, you know. It's the same with fiction, you know. So that's the answer to that question.
So Chicago Whispers was your first foray into chronicling gay history in a book form.
Right. So I wrote the book Chicago Whispers, which covers gay life in Chicago from about 1680 with the French explorers, because they were the first people who mentioned sissy boys in the old Native American tribes. And it ended on the night of Stonewall, because I know that wasn't in Chicago, but I ended on what was going on in the bars in Chicago on the night of Stonewall.
And now there is a sequel to that book that covers the time frame forward of Stonewall.
Right. It goes from the night after Stonewall. It goes to June, from June 69 to June 1975. That was because that's when Gay Life was first published, and that was the first serious newspaper, gay newspaper in Chicago. Prior to that, there'd been attempts at newspapers. One was the Chicago Gay Crusader, but that was very much a sort of hangover from the hippie period, you know. They had no money, you know, really. So, but that did go for 26 issues. Then Gay Life started. So it covers that the period of the early 70s, not just the bars, but you know, the post-Stonewall formation of Catholic groups and, you know, Weight Watchers groups and all the other things that exploded, you know, after Stonewall.
So since you brought it up, and you start all your interviews, started all your interviews this way, what was your first gay bar experience?
Well, it was funny actually. I was way underage, but I wasn't going there because I was gay. My parents in Bath, in England, the gay bar used to be called the Garrick's Head, and it was a gay at least for 100 years. At least nobody knows when it went gay, but there was a bingo hall opposite, and every Saturday night my parents went to bingo, and they would go to the gay bar afterwards for a drink. So if I was downtown when I was 15 or 16 with friends, I'd know where to find them so I could get a lift home. So I used to go to the gay bar to find my parents. So when I started actually going to gay bars because I was gay, I would go to the Garrick's Head. But I've never ever had that. I talk to people more here in America. People had a great terror of going, you know, they drove around the block 3 times when they went to a bar, turned up their collar so nobody recognized them, and were terrified to go in the bars. I never grew up in that environment. I had very liberal parents, you know.
Well, and I think too the environment is a little different there. I've spent a little bit of time in Great Britain, and the general attitude is a little more relaxed. You don't have the tension that you have in a lot of cities here, where you're worried about somebody pulling out a gun if you're walking to your car from the movie theater or whatever. In general, I think people there are less concerned about, you know, random violent crime on the street and
Right.
being, you know, beat up or assaulted than they are here.
It's also people don't grow up with much religion there. They have Christianity light. In my house, we never had Christianity at all because my parents were atheists, but and so am I. But religion can be very damaging. I'm not knocking it, but it can be very damaging for young people. So, you know, people are frightened of not only of being here, not only of being knifed, but they're frightened of Satan, you know, or whatever. So this is a country of very frightened people. That's my impression. And I am American, but that's my impression. And I'm sure it's a lot to do with these I call them Middle Eastern cults.
So we talked a little bit about your first couple of books, and I noticed over your shoulder there is the cover of a striking new book that has not even hit the streets yet.
No, it has not.
This is a book that's coming out in the next month or so. It's coming out, the beginning of September?
Yeah, somewhere around then.
Somewhere around then.
Say September, shall we?
And it's called Last Call Chicago.
Yeah.
And it chronicles 1,001 LGBTQ accommodating spaces in the city of Chicago over the last 100 years.
Right. I'm staggered by that number. So I'm sure other people are going to be very surprised.
Yeah, I was as well. I knew it was coming.
Have you seen the book?
I have
version of it.
I have seen the PDF copy.
Oh, okay.
I've read parts of it.
What do you think?
I think it's amazing. I think it's something that we need from every single city and venue in the country.
Right. Yes.
Whether it's the size of Chicago that has 1,001 bars to talk about, or it's the size of Galveston, Texas, that has, 52.
Right.
Whatever it is, they all need to be chronicled and commemorated because they played such an important part in where our community got, especially in the post-war years. After World War II is, I guess, really when the gay bar community really kind of exploded in the U.S. And it's an amazing book. I mean, I had interviewed Rick, your co-author, Rick Carlin, about a year ago, and he had sent me a little teaser about the book and said that at that point you had discovered, I think, 700 roughly bars in Chicago.
Right.
And I thought, wow, that is amazing for one city. I mean, that, extrapolating that out to the country, that tells us there were probably, tens of thousands of gay bars around the U.S.
Oh, for sure. And I honestly think we've only just scratched the surface. The problem is most of the gay bars we don't know about. In Chicago, we don't know about them. They're gone. They came, they went. And they were never documented. These are bars that are documented, that we found something out about them. And the only way, say in the 40s or in the 50s especially, the only way we found out about gay bars is one, interviewing old people, and the other one was if they got raided, and it was in the newspaper. All the bars that didn't get raided or never made it into the newspaper, we don't know about them. There was many more. I would guess at least another 1,000 bars.
Yeah, that's exactly why I started this project in the first place. I was reminiscing a few years ago about a bar that I loved in Atlanta that I went to very frequently and played a big part in my evolution as a gay adult male. And that bar was Backstreet. And it was this huge multi-level disco with a show bar on the top floor that in its last 15 years of existence was open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It never closed. It never stopped serving liquor. And it started conversations about other bars. And I came to realize that we had spent so much time chronicling the people who led the riots, the political issues, the Anita Bryants who fought against us, all these things that are, kind of wrapped around legal issues and protests and all that. And we neglected to really pay attention to the places that allowed us to form our communities, that gave us, the meeting places and the safe havens to collect and share ideas.
That's right. And that's why that was the only place to go to meet other people was to go to a bar. They were community centers, however oppressive they were. And, I mean, in Chicago, they were completely corrupt. I mean, they were all the mob had most of the bars and were sort of taking money from the other bars. But, thank you, Mafia. Because I don't know where we would have got to. The thing about bars is, when someone's isolated, they can't make any. You can't change things. If you go to a bar and meet one person, there's two of you. Meet three people, there's three of you. Eventually, you have a movement, and it all came from people going to bars because it certainly didn't go from. All that didn't come from men going into the park and having casual sex. And being afraid, they came from going to bars and meeting people and then meeting them outside in their
Absolutely.
homes. That's where it started. People see bars as like a sort of trivial, superficial thing. I think it's the most important thing for the movement. And don't forget, as we know, the new movement started in the Stonewall in a bar.
Right. And even the parts that led up to Stonewall around the country started at other bars,
Right.
at the
I
Black Cat or wherever in different cities.
Yeah, I don't know if you've seen my book Out of the Underground, but there's a lot about but it's Out of the Underground. It's what's the rest of it called? Homosexuals, the Radical Press, and the Rise and Fall of the Gay Liberation Front. That's all over the country. You might want to take a look at that. I can send you a proof copy if you want. But in there, it's got a lot of history about Atlanta and the bars and what went on in the bars in Atlanta. So that
I
might be
would
a book
definitely
you
love to read that.
might.
I lived in Atlanta for about 20 years, and I know a lot of the people that were players in the bar scene from the 70s, 80s, and 90s there. And even to this day, I know some of them. But
This
Atlanta
is
had
most.
a unique distinction, and I'm not sure whether your book goes into this time frame, but in the 70s, when you started having the super bars, the big discos and the giant dance clubs and everything, Atlanta had a tradition almost of like incredible animosity between bar owners. And every time one new bar opened to compete with another, there was arson or, something involved, some kind of violence
Right.
involved. It was so different than what we expect today. People today badmouth a new guy that's opening up down the street, but back then they would burn your bar down.
Right, but were they gay owners? There's the difference between a gay owner of a bar and a straight owner of a
Well,
bar.
several of them were rumored to have organized crime connections, but a couple of them had gay members of the family also. So they're not mutually exclusive. There were mafia-owned bars that had, gay family members running them, so.
Right, well, one thing the thing about Chicago is one thing we can't forget. Chicago was the first state to legalize or at least decriminalize homosexuality in 1961. So what happened was all the obvious gay men around the Midwest, which means feminine, pretty much feminine gay men, all moved to Chicago. There was I can think of at least six drag bars in the 60s. They all moved to Chicago. So there was this huge boom in bars in Chicago in the 60s, all run by the mafia, but all paying off the cops. And that lasted until 1973, when the cops were finally taken to court. And a lot of them ended up in jail for skimming money taking kickbacks from mafia-owned bars, a lot of them gay. I actually wrote, there's a chapter about that in Chicago After Stonewall, about how they were finally got their comeuppance for raking money off the gay bars. But although that's bad, and the police shouldn't have been doing that, and the mob shouldn't have been doing that, it did mean all these bars were open. So people had a place to go. So really, like I said before, thank you, Mafia.
Right. Now, I would love to be able to sit here today and have you kind of go over all 1,000 bars that are in the book, but that is just ludicrous. And we want people to go out and buy it because there are some great graphics in there. I'll show some of them in the course of this interview, but there are some great ads and newspaper clippings and photographs that you and your team have dug up and inserted into the book, so we get more of a flavor than just looking at a name and an address and saying this was here for 2 years. But we did, before we started the interview, we had a chance to talk a little bit about a few of the bars that you wanted to mention, and one of them in particular, I've heard of before, and it definitely the name itself is cause to start a conversation. What were they thinking when they came up with the Canine Club?
Right, I can say exactly what happened. I was interviewing a man in his 90s. He died a week after I actually interviewed him. He said when he was young, underage, he managed to get into an illegal speakeasy with a drag show. It was called, and he knew it was called the K9 Club. He didn't know where it was, he couldn't remember. And of course, it wasn't in the phone book, it was a speakeasy. It was one of Capone's speakeasies, right? So it was in a downtown area. And then some of the other old 70-year-old drag queens I talked to, they told me stories they'd heard about the K9 Club. There's very, with the, I don't know if they do it now, but with the old drag queens, they used to hand down stories, sort of campfire stories of these old drag queens and their history. So I was writing the book Chicago Whispers for the University of Wisconsin Press. And of course, that was not a, I wasn't doing oral history. I was doing factual history. So I couldn't write about the K9 Club unless I could prove it. Well, how do you prove that there was a drag speakeasy? Well, I discovered that in 1933, or whenever Prohibition ended in Chicago, suddenly all these clubs opened. They were just all built overnight, right? So I thought, I wonder if the K9 Club. So I phoned this man, I can't remember his name, he died now, straight guy, but he used to write books about anarchism, of all things, in Chicago. And I phoned him and I said, okay, 1933, what was the scuzziest newspaper in Chicago? Nasty tabloid. And he said, the Chicago American. So from the, I went to the Harold Washington Library and I sat in front of the microfilm and just let it pass before my eyes. And I can skip read. I can see words jumping out that I need, and you could press a button and get a free photocopy. I've got thousands of them. I cost them a fortune. But I thought, well, I wonder if they opened after Prohibition ended. And sure enough, there was an ad. And the ad is in my book, Chicago Whispers, for the K9 Club. And it's got a very feminine figure. And I think it's saying, oh, please. Of course, Mayor Kelly closed it down. But because of that ad, I proved it existed. And then I could tell some of the oral history that I'd heard. Like once the Prohibition cops raided the bar and the drag queens came down the fire escape at the back. And there was one drag, and there was a Prohibition cop guarding it. And one drag queen took off a heel and hit him over the head and ran. So I don't know if those stories are true, but that bar existed. I proved that it existed. And I did say some of the stories about the place.
Yeah, and people don't realize how difficult it is to document some of these bars, even up until right around the end of World War II or a little beyond, because in
Well, you've got to.
general, they didn't advertise.
Oh, no, they didn't advertise. You've got a. The earliest ads we've got are from the 60s.
They didn't publicize their
No, they did not.
location. A lot of times they didn't even have a proper sign. So if somebody had a picture of that block of the street, you wouldn't know that there was a gay bar or any bar there, because it would just be a rusty brown door with, a number on it or something.
That's right. That's right.
And a lot of times the entrances were in the rear of the bar, so you wouldn't be seen walking in off the street and be outed by, friends, neighbors, whatever. So
Well, one old guy told me that he said you could tell a gay bar from the in Chicago, you could tell a gay bar from the outside. They had very, very small window at the front for the cops to look in. But you couldn't really see much looking out.
right.
That was one thing they did, you know. But the restrictions in the bars were terrible. I mean, you had to keep your hands on top of the counter in some of the bars. You couldn't put your hand below the counter. You
Yeah,
had to have.
you couldn't physically touch another person in the
Oh, no,
bar.
you couldn't touch another person at all. I've heard a rumor, and I don't know if this is true, that in Boston, there was a. And someone said that there was another one in Washington, D.C. I don't know, but someone told me there was a bar in Boston where all the tables were separate and they had phones on the table and you could phone another table.
I've heard that. I'm not sure if it was in
I'm
Boston,
not sure if it's true or not.
but I've heard that story before, and I know there were some later. There were some going into the 70s and 80s in
Yeah.
Atlanta that had phones in the bar like that
Wow.
also.
Wow. Wow. There was an old bar in Chicago. It was a speak another speakeasy. It's in the book, and it was run by this woman called Pauline. And you couldn't speak to anybody in the bar. You had to go in, sit down, and if you wanted to buy somebody a drink, if you saw someone at the other end of the bar and you wanted to buy them a drink, you asked Pauline, and she went down there and she served them a drink, even though you're not allowed to speak to them. But you could only do it once. I got stories of the lesbian bars, you know, the Marge Summit, who was a bar owner in Chicago. She told me that in the 50s she was a they were butch and femme. She was a butch, and they used to dress like that. Only in Chicago, you had the women had to wear three items of female apparel. They couldn't wear jeans with a zip at the front. That was considered to be a man, or a shirt with the buttons on the wrong side. That was a man. And the shoes, but these gals used to dress up as men, and if they when the police would come in the front door, they'd run in the bathroom, hold the door shut, and swap clothes with their girlfriends, swap shoes and everything. Marge said it was a scream because people would come walking out with shoes that obviously weren't theirs.
Yeah, there were some quirky behaviors that went on back in the day in the gay bar scene because of these ridiculous laws and the things that the local police would enforce to try to suppress the gay bar activity.
Well, they couldn't. You couldn't dance in the bars legally until the early 70s, when the Gay Liberation Front demonstrated outside of the Normandy Bar. This was in Chicago, I'm talking about. Now, there were bars before that. There was a bar in the 60s called the Front Page, and they used to lock the front door for a couple of songs so you could dance with your partner. So yeah, they always found ways of getting around all this stuff.
Now, you also mentioned another bar from Chicago's past that was called the Shoreline Seven.
Yeah. That was well, if I could have a time machine, that's the bar I go to. They I we do have an ad for that. That was open from the mid 40s to the mid 60s. It's hard to say who owned the bar. But it was run by a man called Ralph Marco, and the rumor was that he was Ralph Capone, Capone's son. He wasn't. Ralph Capone did own adult bookstores in the suburbs, apparently, but I wasn't writing about adult bookstores. But Ralph Marco and his Great Dane, I think he was called Smiley, ran this bar. At the back of the bar is where the cops, the politicians met to do their deals. Now, I interviewed Blondina. I heard about this bartender, and I went to Blondina's house, and nobody knows her real name, even I don't know it, but Blondina was very old and told me that he worked at the Shoreline 7 and on the first behind the bar, and the first day he got there, Ralph showed him three guns taped under the bar, loaded guns taped under the bar, and he was told, if you have any problems, just shoot them, lock the front door, and we'll deal with it. That was what it was like.
Wow.
Amazing. And I talked to a load of I talked to a I can't remember his name, a black drag queen that performed there, and I got all these incredible stories about this place. Ralph Marco, before that, he owned a, excuse the old-fashioned language, a midget bar for dwarves and midgets. Now, there was a midget bar in Chicago, but I don't know if that's the one that Ralph owned. But no, everybody went to the Shoreline 7. Senator Dirk Erickson, no, what was his, Everett? No, I can't remember. I was going to name a senator that used to go there, but I can't remember his name. I can't remember his name now. Maybe I shouldn't name him anyway. But he used to go there to meet the cops. There were judges there as well.
Now, you did mention Capone, who of course is probably the most famous mobster from Chicago. Everybody I think on the planet knows who he is, and we even had our friend Geraldo Rivera go digging in his closet trying to find something. But another bar that you mentioned in our conversation last week was one that was allegedly owned by the Capone gang, and that was the Wind Up Lounge.
Yeah, the wind up. I found out about the wind up. My first tip off was somebody gave me the name of a man. He lived in Santa Fe. I interviewed him over the phone. He was pretty ancient, lovely man. He was a bartender at the wind up. I'd never heard of the wind up, but he was a bartender at the wind up bar when it was the big raid in 1949 when it closed down. So he gave me a first-hand account of what actually happened in the raid, which is wonderful. But then I met someone who was stand outside of the bar, because when they raided the bar, all the other gay bars in that area emptied out and everybody went to see who was being arrested. So Frank gave me a an account of what happened inside the bar, and this other guy I met gave me an account of what happened outside of the bar as they were pulling people out. Then when I looked at the newspapers, it's like there's a lot of people arrested. And Frank told me, because he was a bartender, but his parents were quite influential apparently, when they got to the police station, his parents paid off the cops and got him out. But he had to leave town. This is in 1949. He went to New York. I interviewed him 30, 40 years later or whatever. He was still frightened to come back to Chicago.
Wow. And you know, it's important that stories like this get preserved also because, as you mentioned earlier, you know, for a lot of people in the gay community, 1969, the Stonewall Uprising is kind of a line of demarcation in gay history for what happened as far as our freedoms and our speaking up for ourselves and what have you. But there are so many other events, including the one we just discussed, the Wind Up Lounge,
Oh, yeah.
20 years earlier.
Right. Yeah, and there was Louis Gage's, and also these are the newspaper accounts of all this. the race. Louis Gage's in 1964 was devastating. We had allegedly suicides. I cannot find a suicide. But like all these people were arrested, I forget how many. And there was a lot of teachers there and they all lost their jobs. When you got raided, what I think what young people maybe need to know is if you got caught in a raid then, you probably lost, well, you lose your job. You lose your career completely. And you probably lose your family as well. A lot of people did. I've interviewed people who told their parents they were gay, or their parents found out they were gay in the 1950s. They've seen no family members since then.
Yeah. And a lot of them, too, you know, people don't realize this, but in most places in the country, there was no housing protection either. So you could be denied housing or ejected from your housing.
Two men could not get a mortgage in Chicago at all. And in most areas could not even rent an apartment if it was two men.
Right. And no, if you were found out to be gay in one of these raids, thrown out of your apartment.
Yeah, but kicked out of your apartment, kicked out off your job, you know. Yeah, I mean, I heard stories like that all the time. I must have interviewed 500 or 600 people to do the column. And I heard some. But then there's amazing stories as well. I interviewed an African-American woman. And at the end of the interview, I always say, is there anything? And she was wonderful. She'd gone to Woodstock, you know, it was really interesting. She was very much an activist. But I said, is there anything I should have asked you that I didn't? And she said, well, I was in the Black Panthers. And I thought, you forgot to mention that? You know, she didn't mention that. No, she was in the Black Panthers. So that was another interesting thing. That's another thing people don't realize with gay people. You could go to a gay bar and you can meet a bag boy in a supermarket, a judge. Now, I'm talking about now, a politician. You know, you can meet a cocaine dealer. You can meet anybody. Gay people socialize in a way much wider group of people than straight people. Straight people tend to socialize with either with people at work, maybe a neighbor, certainly family, and maybe if they're church-going people, the church. But mostly that's their own class of people. They're that type of people. Whereas, well, you're probably the same. I have judges. I have two judges who are personal friends of mine. I know someone who's a bag boy in a supermarket. I know you meet all kinds of people. And that was really, to me, the joy of interviewing all these people. I consider it to be a great privilege that these people have shared their lives with me. And they all start the same. They all say, oh, my life is boring, you know. You know, and then it turns out it's not boring at all. It's just boring to them because they had it day to day, you know.
Right.
Nobody's life is boring. Nobody. Nobody at all. I've discovered that as a journalist. And I'm really not interested in interviewing Boy George and all that. I mean, I'm sure they're all, I'm not interested in that. I'm really interested in the waiter. You know, that's, I used to go to these big AIDS events and I'd end up in the kitchen talking to the kitchen staff because it's more interesting, really, to be honest.
And I've told everybody that I've interviewed, which we're approaching 100 now, 100 interviews for this project that are all, I don't know, 45 minutes or so, an hour long. And I've told everybody that if you know somebody that I should interview, please pass my information along.
Right.
They do not have to be famous. They do not have to be a bar owner. They do not have to be a celebrity or an entertainer.
Right.
Because everybody that is gay has a gay bar story somewhere in their life, and that bar and that information needs to be recorded. I don't only need to know which gay bars Elton John went to, because
right.
You know, that's But like you said, sometimes the most interesting stories and the most obscure references come from people that are, busboys, waiters, bartenders,
That's
lighting
right.
techs, whatever they are.
If you look in Last Call, we name not we can't name all the employees, but we do name we've named a couple of doormen. If I we've got their names, we put them in. Because that's the bar isn't just the owner. It's not just the famous, B. Arthur walked in there one day. It's not just that. It's just everybody. The bar back, the DJ especially, People used to go to, especially in the 70s boom of disco, which I wanted nothing to do. I hate disco. But I mean, that was really important time. The DJs were like the gods. So, no, we've named every DJ we could find that actually worked in a gay bar in Chicago. And of course, with that project, a lot of the bars, some of the bars, we just have the name of it. And it was around in 1950, and that's all we have. And that's all we've put in. And a lot of the people, there's a lot of memories in there for people, which I use my Chicago Whispers column when they talked about the bars, and we put them in. Especially with the African American bars, because they're really subdued, and some of them are in areas that you really don't want everybody to know it's a gay bar. So people remembering those gay bars, it's really important. Although it's oral history.
I'm glad you mentioned that because I've gotten some flack from people. Of course, it's always the people that, are outside the loop. They're not recording anything. They're not trying to preserve any history. They're just commenting from the peanut gallery. But
Yeah, I
so many
know.
times I get people say to me, "Well, you've got all these, thousands of bars that you've found information on, but very few black bars or women's bars." And I said, "That is not my fault." And any historian, I'm sure you'll say the same thing. First of all, the gay bars and I mean the black bars and the lesbian bars did not generally advertise as
No.
frequently as the mainstream white bars did. Secondly, the people who went there are not as eager to talk about them. I have
No.
posted hundreds of posts saying anybody who has a bar they want to talk about, private message me or email me. And 95% of them are white men that
No, I
respond.
know. No. You're right, and there's reasons for it. I mean, in Chicago, if you look at the early gay press in Chicago, it looks pretty white,
Absolutely.
and that's partly the fault, I think, of the people working for the paper and not reaching out. And maybe it is racism. I don't know. I wasn't there, but you don't see ads that. The African American community in Chicago, which was the South Side, used to be a very segregated city. It still is, to a certain extent. But those bars did not participate in post-Stonewall at the beginning. Yes, there were African Americans doing it, but all those bars on the South Side were closeted. A lot of them were closeted. They did not want to bring attention to themselves. So you can't go back and find an ad for some of these bars because they didn't advertise. It may also have been financial as well, Maybe they just couldn't afford to do it. But and the women's bars don't tend not to last very long, And that's also probably an economic thing that women don't have, maybe don't have as much money as men,
Yeah, I've heard that. It's also that I think, especially when you go back into the heyday of the gay bar scene, probably from the mid to late '60s forward to the '90s or so, gay men tended to be more promiscuous, and they would go out for the purpose of hooking up and meeting other people. So you might go out 3 or 4 or 5 nights a week,
Right.
whereas the women would go out once in a while to have a beer and play a game of
Right.
pool with their girlfriend, and then they would get a U-Haul and move in together, and you'd never have to go back to the bar again.
Right. No, that's right. And also, what another thing that happened in Chicago is in the early 70s, women got sick of going to these mafia lesbian bars. There was one bar that would put up pictures of showgirls on the wall, right? Well, at a time of heightened feminism, right?
Right.
They didn't want to see that. So what they did in Chicago, they started creating cafes, and there was Chicago lesbians were. It was very much a cafe society. To get away from that, also there was a chronic alcohol problem with lesbians because they were going to the bars and getting drunk, you know. So there was that going on as well. But what we do have in the book, we do have a lot of bars from the south side of Chicago, black bars, because of the jazz clubs. You know, there was a lot of jazz clubs down there that where gay people went. You notice back in the 40s and 50s, white people went to the south side bars and were welcomed. Black people coming to the north side bars, not so much.
Yeah, I think that didn't happen.
If you see black people in the North Side bars in the 60s or the early 70s, they were playing the piano or they were a drag queen. A lot of black piano players that we've written about them in the book, you
I think
know.
the kind of turning point, as far as the black people coming into the white neighborhoods, the white bars, was probably the advent of the disco era. When
Yeah,
disco
that.
started getting big, because
Yeah.
so many of the artists were people of color,
Right.
and the whole environment that was different, you started to see more integration in those bars.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, that's true, yeah. But I don't, you know, what I've done with the books I've written is I just write the facts. I don't analyze. I don't have my own opinions in there. I'm from England, you know. I don't know why, you know, all this happened. All I know is I research it and say this happened, and here is where it says it happened, you know. But why things happened, like why there was this apparent racism, and you know, and why black people never went to the white bars on the North Side. That's for somebody else to do. You know, that's another
Get a
historic.
psychologist. Get a psychologist.
Yeah, that's somebody else. I really don't know anything about that. I just know it happened.
So
You know.
when you were writing Last Call Chicago, I know you'd done a lot of research beforehand. You had your whole body of work from the publications you worked with,
Right.
but yet you were still surprised that you were able to catalog over 1,000 gay venues in the Chicago area in that time frame.
Well, it's a staggering number. You know, people think that we were fringe. They think it was like a freak thing being gay. It's like, where did, I don't know what the percentage, say it's 10%, whatever the hell it is, I don't care. But say 10% of the population is gay. They went somewhere, you know. America's very strange. They think if they ignore something, you know, if they say you can't, like in Florida, you can't say the word gay, it's like it disappears. It doesn't disappear. People go, when they closed down the brothels in Chicago in 1910, they thought, well, that was a good job done. Well, the brothels opened somewhere else.
Right, the prostitutes didn't go away.
No. So it's like, you know, you put on a bustier, or you put on a corset, you think you're fit thinner, but the fat comes out everywhere else. You know, it still comes out. It's still there. So all these thousands of people in Chicago, they went somewhere. They didn't sit home knitting, you know. But I'm still surprised we found 1,000. I mean,
So
some of them had gay-friendly nights, you know, they had a night once a week or something. But these were all places that we were welcomed at some point.
Right. And that's all you really can do, especially before World War II, because back then nobody advertised that they were a gay bar. There
Right.
was, it was a lot of these kind of like we think of, back in Oscar Wilde's day, these salons, these
Right.
places where, people who were philosophers and artists and whatever, radical thinkers met and had cocktails together and whatever. They were very bohemian type places.
And they were privileged as well, because I'll tell you, most people, and that was happening in England, they were privileged people. They weren't working in the factories.
Right.
We're never going to find out what we can do Oscar Wilde, and we know his every movement, and the trial and everything, and Virginia Woolf, we know about them, but they're very privileged people. The truck drivers or whatever, the train drivers, the porters, you don't ever hear about them. But they went somewhere. We met each other. We always met, however much they try to stop us meeting. That's what they hate. They can take one homosexual, a clown on TV, or the wacky uncle who never got married. They like that. Give them two homosexuals, that's when they panic. And when you got like in Chicago, there's 1 million people at Pride every year. That's terrifying. That's a threat. And it is a threat. Don't
So most
forget, Stonewall was a riot.
right.
It wasn't a picnic. It wasn't anybody waving banners. It was a riot.
Well, you spent a lot of time writing about gay life in Chicago, both for publications and in a variety of your books. You're now living on the West Coast. You're in sunny California. Are there any plans to kind of split from that Midwestern gay history concept and move on to anything from the West? Or what's coming up the road? What's the next step in your life?
I don't plan to write any more history books. And that doesn't mean I won't. It means I don't plan to. I started out writing comedy. I'm actually a comedy writer. And so now recently wrote a book called Twilight Manners, God's Waiting Room. Twilight Manners in Palm Springs, God's Waiting Room. And it's done so incredibly well that I've just written a sequel that's coming out next month. And I'm actually working on a third one, which is comedy. I do feel like I've done my bit. And also, the last call, Chicago, exhausted me. I'm sure Rick was exhausted as well. It was merciless. It was only like a stubbornness that actually got us through with that book. You've seen the book.
I have.
The amount of research is incredible. What we've done.
I am so excited for the physical copy to be in my hands, and I can't say enough about it. I really wish that every gay historian everywhere in the country would attempt to do something on that level for their local scene. Because there is so much information out there that is not being preserved. And as you said, you've interviewed people who were in their 90s and passed away a week, a month later after you interviewed them. Those people are the more and more of them are dying every day. And we're losing the stories of stuff that happened, 75 years ago. I
Yeah, I know.
mean, those people are not going to be around forever.
Well, that made me frantic. I mean, that just drove me on when I was writing the column for the paper. I was getting people who were, didn't have long to go. I interviewed a lot. Of course, I'm old. I'm 70, but back then was in
Well,
my
you don't
50s.
always know. I mean, I was scheduled to interview a drag queen last year, who was, I think, 70 or 71, and she passed away before we scheduled the interview. We had
I
scheduled the
know.
interview, but we never got around to it, because you never know.
Well, there is a Palm Springs group run by a wonderful man, David Gray. And it is collecting history of Palm Springs, gay Palm Springs, and they're working on that. So, Palm Springs Gay, there is a Palm Springs Gay History book, but it's really about celebrities. You know, Rock Hudson and Liberace at a house here is, but I mean, Palm Springs is very celebrity based.
Yeah, and there were a couple of designers. I can't remember who they were, but
Well, they all sort of, you know, they all pass through a bit of a whorehouse, really. Well, I live in Cathedral City, outside of Palm Springs, and Cathedral City was the gay area. Then it
right.
started to move into Palm Springs. All the gay bars were in Cathedral City. They weren't in Palm Springs. They wouldn't allow them.
Yeah,
They
I've
were.
run across a few of them there.
But you know, that's. But where do you do your research? I'll tell you what I've got here, and I don't know what to do with them. I was working for a paper in Chicago that closed down, and they were throwing everything away. And it was heartbreaking. And I grabbed some boxes of newspapers. And what it was were newspapers from all over the country for June 1987 and June 1988. I have them. It's about four or five boxes here. And of course, it has all the ads from the bars from that year, that month, you know.
Yeah, I've had some
I
people
don't have
that
time to go through with and pull them all out, though, you know.
I've had some people that have sent me publications like that, and I've gone through and scanned them or photographed the ads or whatever. I've gone down to since I live in Florida, down in Fort Lauderdale, there's the Stonewall National Museum and Archives, which
Right. I've heard
has
that. Yeah.
they have well Rick lives there.
Rick lives.
And Stonewall National Museum and Archives has stuff from all over the country, both in their archival department. And they also have an interesting aspect of their museum, which is a lending library. So, like your new book will probably be on the shelf there,
Yeah.
and some gay person can walk in there and check it out for a couple of days, take it home and read it.
Yes, it's
So
great. It
it
it's not. I don't think it's a book you would sit and read it. But Rick and I look at it in different ways, which doesn't matter, you know, because the book is there. I do see the book as more as a coffee table book, and Rick sees it more as a sort of academic book. I mean, if it does get taken up by academics, like my first book, Chicago Whispers, is in, you know, university libraries everywhere, and some it's been studied as well by some colleges, the book. But I don't know if that would happen to this. I see it as a picture book.
guess we'll see. Time will tell.
Pick it up and look through it. I mean, it's really. I don't know if, but I don't know. I don't know the effect it's going to have. We wanted to do, I mean, it was Rick's idea, wasn't my idea. I had all this accumulated, all this stuff, ads and stuff, because I hoard, not in life, but on a computer, I hoard things, you know. And so I had all this stuff. But when he contacted me and asked me to do it, I knew it was going to be a big project. But with his knowledge of the bars, I mean, I knew the history of a lot of these bars, but he actually went to these bars from the mid-70s up until 2000s, you know. He was actually in the bars. We both wrote about the bars. Now, he did a column which was a gossip column. Now, people don't realize, they think that's trivial, but I'll tell you, if you're doing gay history, go to the gossip columns, because that tells you what people were actually doing. So he might write a piece of gossip, oh, this drag queen has gone away on vacation this week, or this bartender has done this. That's not documented in the ads.
Right.
So the gossip column is actually what these people were doing. And also, they make little bar celebrities of people. Chicago Molly was a celebrity, and you know, these were not always performers either. They were just celebrities in the bar. Someone
Character.
told me at the Nightlife, which was a 1940s drag bar in Chicago, there was a guy that came in with a chicken. He always had a chicken on his shoulder, Now you're not gonna get that from a newspaper, you know?
Right.
But in this, if that happened in the 70s, Rick was there writing it down. That's very important. Gossip columns, don't underestimate gossip columns. It's full of information.
Well, I am so glad that you and Rick and Owen Keenan and all these people from Chicago are making these grand efforts to commemorate and preserve these stories of so many of the bars from Chicago because, like I said, I wish every city would do it, but I am so glad you've done it. And I'm really excited to actually read The Last Call Chicago in its book form when it comes out next month. So thank you so
Well,
much.
I do want to mention that the whole thing was designed by Ratley Good Yarns by Ian Hensel. How he put it all together, I don't know. There was hundreds of images. He had to work on every single image. So.
And it looks great. I mean, I can tell from the PDF version, I'm seeing the pages just the way they are in the book, and it looks great. It doesn't look like a phone book with a bunch of listings in
No,
it. It's
no.
really graphically, engaging. It's got some very cool ads and pictures in there.
A lot of photographs that I took, actually.
And Rattling Good Yarns, the whole contribution of how many different gay titles are under that umbrella is amazing. So I would encourage anybody to go to the rattlinggoodyarns.com website and check out, the list of authors they have there, the titles that are offered. There's a lot of books that Suki has done. There's a couple of books by Rick. I recently interviewed Owen Keenan. His book is in there, which he did with you also.
Oh, that was a project. That was interesting. That was him saying, or one of us said, I wonder what would happen if we asked every gay person in the world the same question. And we did. We opened it up to anybody in the world to answer 10 questions, and we did a book called Tell Me About It. And it was just things like, when did you come out to your parents? When did you first realize you were gay? That kind of thing. Well, in the end, it went into 3 volumes. And we had everybody. We even had an Italian prince answer who lives in Bulgaria to answer the questions. It was amazing. That was quite a project with Owen. Owen is passionate about gay history.
Well, thank you so much for all your contributions, and thank you for taking the time to tell us about them today. We really appreciate it.
Well, thank you.
That concludes another episode of the Gay Bar Archive Show. For more information about this episode, or to find more episodes, visit gaybararchives.com.